Movies and Booze on Moncrief.
Proudly sponsored by Carryout, Ireland's leading independent off-licence. Carryout.ie.
How about some Movies and Booze?
Movies and Booze on Moncrief.
Proudly sponsored by Carryout, Ireland's leading independent off-licence. Carryout.ie.
We are joined once again by Tomás Clancy and Esther McCarthy. Good afternoon to you both.
Good afternoon.
Hello, how are you?
Yeah, and it's been a while since you've been in with us, Tomás.
It is in the studio. It's a fantastic location. I feel, you know, the world could be launched upon from here. It's fabulous.
And may well be at some future point, but, you know, I can't say for sure. So what wine will we be looking at today, Tomás?
We are looking at wines from Spain. We're looking from Ribera del Duero, and we're going to be talking about Irish sugar, or sugar. Aaron, and the similarities between Ribera del Duero and Carlo.
Right.
And then there is a strong, there's an amazing connection. The whole of the Ribera del Duero owes its existence, really, in its modern form, to the same thing that struck Carlo, which was the access to of English sugar, Tate & Lyle and other companies like that, when the EU broke down the barriers for those kind of sugars to come in, cane sugars, and kind of wiped out the sugar that was made from beet all over Europe. Mm. And it wiped out us in Carlo,
yeah.
And it took a long time to recover, whereas it did the same in Ribera del Duero. But they had a slight history of growing wine, of growing of viticulture, and they were able to move back towards that. So it's kind of it's a fascinating region. Doesn't look like Carlo, I will give you that.
Carlo was lovely in its own way.
It's a beautiful, beautiful place, yeah. But this is 3,000 feet in the sky. It's a mountainous region. It's very, very high.
Yeah. Does Irish sugar exist anymore?
Sugar Aaron.
I don't think it does.
I don't think it does, yeah. No. And actually, the real loss is, you know, I absolutely loved the large individuated granules that came with Sucre Aaron, whereas now you get this kind of stuff that's very akin to sand,
yeah.
Just white sand. It's very, very, very poor.
Indeed. Our hashtag, by the way, is Seepage Movies. That's not connected with the piece we just did. It's connected to a piece we were with Graham Finlay earlier on in the week, where he was he did this piece about words that prompt a disgust response in people. Seepage was one of the the favourite words, though moist seems to be still the winner. People hate the word moist.
Oh God, yes.
Do you hate the word moist too?
I absolutely loathe the word moist. There's something very off-putting about it.
Esther, how do you feel about moist?
I'm a bit creeped out right now. I was
I phrased that badly, it should be said. So, what the world's been waiting for, another Avengers movie.
Yes. Little film. Won't do any business at the box office,
no,
I reckon.
Of course not.
Yeah, it's grand. It's a very ambitious film, this, because what they're trying to do is bring all the different story threads from all the different characters and spin-offs together. So you've got all the Avengers here, but they're fighting an intergalactic war against Thanos, the baddie, who's very well played by Josh Brolin. So they join forces with newer characters like the Guardians of the Galaxy and even the characters from Wakanda and Black Panther, which only saw a couple of months ago. So I'm not sure.
The actors' fees alone must have been enormous on
this
film.
I'm not sure how many superheroes are in it. I lost count after 20.
But crikey.
Yeah, it's an ambitious job to pull all those story threads together and give people enough screen time and develop characters and all of that stuff that you're trying to do.
So
in the film.
Is the film 5 hours long?
It's 2.5.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, it's too long. Of course it's too long, but I thought it was going to be longer. There was speculation that it was going to be just shy of 3 hours.
Crikey.
So, yeah.
Yeah. Right, so, okay.
A bit more about whether that works or not.
Yeah, okay. And The Delinquent Season, about which I have heard very little.
Yeah, this is an interesting one. It's an Irish film. It's the directorial debut, well, on screen at least. He's a very well-known theatre director, of course, Marco Rowe, who's written a lot of well-known screenplays over the years, such as Intermission, I suppose, most famously, and wrote the really good drama Boy A as well for television, kind of based very loosely on the Jamie Bulger case, which was really good. So here he's kind of getting behind the camera for the first time in classic writer mode, because he's tired of handing over control to other filmmakers, and he's having a go himself and trying to see a creative project through himself. And he's assembled quite a cast in doing so, including Cillian Murphy and Andrew Scott, who are two of our very best known actors at the moment, of course.
Right. Okay. That's all to look forward to over the next hour or so. Our hashtag, by the way, is Seepage Movies, The Diarrhea of Anne Frank. We'll be back in a couple of minutes. 1850 453 106 is our low call number. Our text number is 53106. That will cost you 30 cents. You can follow us on Facebook or Twitter, or send us an email to afternoon@newstalk.com. Tomás Clancy and Esther McCarthy are with us once again for Movies and Booze. Can you please ask Esther if I have to make, if I have to have watched every Marvel movie there ever was to make sense of Infinity Wars? Dara wants to know.
Not everyone there ever was, but I would definitely say more than any of the other Marvel films, you need some sort of knowledge of the characters and previous plot lines, because this becomes a bit of a soap opera. I don't necessarily mean that in a bad way, but you know, people have digs at each other over things they said to each other 2 years ago and stuff, and you know, when superheroes are picking on each other. So you'd want to be very, very well acquainted with the characters and with the circumstances of at least some of the previous films.
Can you ask Tomás about a Spanish red from Bierzo, B-I-E-R-Z-O, called Tilness?
It's again Bierzo, I think that's how they seem to pronounce it. It's a fantastic sort of red wine region out on the western edge of Spain in Galicia, the so-called green and wet part of Spain. That's as green and wet as Morocco compared to sort of Carlo or Waterford, let me tell you. But it certainly does have a bit of Atlantic influence, and it's from the Mencia grape, and it's a great wine. There are you want to look in places like Joe Carwig's down in Carrigaline in Cork, 64 Wine out in Glastool, and Just Divine up on the north side. So kind of slightly specialist independent wine shops, and you should be able to find you'll get your Bierzo fix.
Yeah, but it is gettable.
It is gettable, yes.
Yeah. Has Esther seen that The Quiet Place already has a sequel greenlit? Already, says the texter.
Brilliant. I'm delighted to hear it. I loved A Quiet Place, as you know. I'm not at all surprised to hear that there'd be trying to get a sequel out fast. The numbers it has done have been phenomenal. Mm. It's been number one in the Irish box office for 3 weeks now.
Okay.
That is unheard of outside of kind of the Avengers or the main blockbuster summer season. So for the fact that a little film, and it's a relatively little film, can do that kind of appeal and pull in that kind of audience is amazing, I think.
Yeah.
And yeah, if I was a producer, I'd be handing John Krasinski a blank check and saying, fill that in there for yourself and get behind the camera again, please.
Okay, but having seen the film, a sequel is doable, and it won't be ridiculous enough to bring back somebody from the dead, or you know, those kind
It is doable, yeah. I hope they have new ideas in there, maybe, because that's what made A Quiet Place so unique, I think. But I'd certainly be open to it, yeah.
Yeah, somebody wants to know, where might I find a good value Pinotage? Seems rare in Dublin.
It is rare in Dublin. We used to have several actually dedicated South African wine shops in Temple Bar and all across the town. I mean, they were actually, there was quite a few of them. South African wines have faded. They faded in popularity, but you can still find some. And you will find a very good Pinotage out from Searson's out in Monkstown. Mm. And it's called, I'm now going to murder it, but it's called Viriga Lessin. And it's one of these Pinotage that smells like, when you put your nose into it, it's like freshly ground coffee. Really remarkable Pinotage, which really sort of steps it out from all the other ones, which smell like horrible bandages and are just vile, you know, just like particularly those wet ones that were in oil that you use for people who had burns, you know, so it smells just like that. So this one is a good one, and you can have a look there. And I think Dunstores had one which was had something like the coffee pot, or it had a coffee type name on the front. So there's a few little places.
Patrick is looking for Maltese wine in Ireland.
Right. No, I've not seen Maltese wine in Ireland. I'm sure I could be wrong, but I haven't seen it around, I'm afraid. Sorry.
This is an odd one, just because of the way it's phrased. Mark says, I'm meeting the girlfriend's mother-in-law. I really want to impress. What wine will I bring? I'm 36 and I feel like I'm 18 again. I'm so nervous, says Mark. Let's go back to the first sentence there, Mark. Mm-hmm. You're meeting your girlfriend's mother-in-law. Is your girlfriend married?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. Or is it the girlfriend's mother-in-law to be? Isn't that your own mother? Have you had a glass of wine before you wrote this text, Mark? That's so vague, it's impossible to answer, really.
Or potentially this is a kind of a Freudian, my future mother-in-law.
Let's assume that's what he means.
So we could be going that way. In which case, La Grande Dame, a really beautiful champagne from Veuve Clicquot. So it's the Widow Clicquot. So it's a female-driven, female-invented, created a champagne brand, and it's that's their top cuvée. I think it's about 120 euros. You could not offend with it, I think, is what we would say there.
Okay. Miriam says, heading to the Côte d'Azur and I can't wait. I haven't been on a holiday in 9 years. 9 years. Please tell me what great wine to drink, because I don't want to waste time on anything crap.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, gosh, we're all Miriam. Willing to come with you, I think, is the key thing to the Côte d'Azur. What you want to do is look out for Bandol. Bandol is the kind of the Saint-Emilion of Provence and the Côte d'Azur. And it has really deep, red, luscious, polished, glossy wines. Domaine Ott is absolutely fantastic down there. There's another one called Chateau Loubet, or Loubet, and that's owned by the people, it's the family who own JCB tractors. Hmm. And they've invested a little cash down there, just outside Bandol. Beautiful sort of location. And, of course, one of our own is down there, Chateau Lacoste, which is Paddy McKillen, the owner of the Press Up Group and every restaurant in Dublin, it seems. And he has Chateau Lacoste, and that's a very nice sort of Côte de Provence, which is down there too. So just avoid the kind of straight, plain sort of Rosé de Provence.
Yeah.
Ask for those names and anything from Chateau Simon, which we just don't get in this country, which is the smallest appellation in France. And it's just north, it's between Aix-en-Provence and Bandol, about halfway between the two. And it is a staggering wine made from Grenache and Syrah and Mourvèdre. And it's like, you'd be very surprised. It's like it's a cross between a Châteauneuf du Pape and a really nice Bordeaux, a stunning wine.
Okay,
really worth looking out for.
That sounds lovely. That's worth the trip.
Absolutely
worth the trip. Ruth says, I finally saw The Quiet Place. It was the best movie of the year, hands down. I went on Esther's recommendation and I loved it. I'll always abide by the gospel according to Esther from now on, says Ruth. Well, Esther has some great investment opportunities for you, Ruth, later on. My posh show-off husband is cooking duck liver this weekend for a party and we're having, and asked me to get the wine. Sure, I've no idea. Any suggestions?
It's got to be Pinot Noir. A really lovely Pinot Noir would do the trick there. You want a wine that has a little bit of opulence but plenty of acidity and cut to get through the duck, and Pinot Noir is one of those ones that you would batch with it. Felton Road Pinot Noir from New Zealand is a really great sideways move to look at. New Zealand Pinot Noir is all the fashion and all the rage now, and it's a little better price than trying to get, but if you could, Gevrey Chambertin will do it all the time.
Yes.
That is a really beautiful wine to have with duck. But some great Pinot Noir coming out of New Zealand, you won't go too far wrong there.
Super Value had an Italian wine which was amazing, Barone Montalto, Nero d'Avola. They said they can't get it anymore. Any idea who else might carry it? Well, now, presumably there's loads of Nero d'Avola.
Yes, there's tons of Nero d'Avola. Yes, what happens there is this is the crucial difference between wine and baked beans.
Yeah.
And that is that they have a vintage, they grow it in a field, they squish it, bottle it and sell it to us. And when it's gone, as they say, It's gone.
Yeah.
So I apologize. I can assure you they are getting that back in again, but it'll be next year's vintage and it'll be there for you again. But there's plenty of Nero d'Avola.
The carry-out off-license on Barrack Street in Waterford in Tremore has a lovely pinotage called Butterfly Tree.
Right.
Says the texter. Excellent. And someone else says, does your movie guru not think A Quiet Place was a complete knockoff of Signs? I enjoyed it, but it was too similar to Signs and I found myself pointing out the similarities every few minutes. I must say, I haven't seen Signs.
I've seen Signs. It's been a while. I don't see similarities with it at all, actually.
Yeah.
Other than the genre, maybe. I didn't see many story similarities there at all.
Yeah. Has Tomás ever been to a wine pairing dinner? I was looking at booking one for me and my wife's anniversary, but they're upwards of £300. Does price equal quality?
No, price doesn't equal quality. I've done a few over the last week myself, he says, you know. And so I partake in such things on a fairly regular basis.
Oh, I thought you'd be hosting them.
Oh, yes, I am. Yeah, sorry. When I say participate, I mean hosting said same. Yeah, so I've done a few of those. So I do host those kind of things. They do go on. And we're not going to do an ad here. Let me just say there's plenty of nice people out there across the country doing those. And I can assure you the way to do this is go and have a look in your local wine shop. shops. And in the local wine shop, you'll find that they will run an evening, and they will often be able to do it at a huge discount. So all of the large multiples, I'm sure Carryout do it, I'm sure I know O'Brien's do it, and so forth. And they host evenings where they will get a lot of Italian wines and then pair them with Italian food, a lot of Spanish wines, pair them with Spanish food. I can assure you the regular price for those kind of things, whoever's giving you this £300, they need to contact me soon. But no, they're from €25 for charcuterie right the way up to sort of whole meals, which are €85 for a person with an evening of five or six wines. If you go to a restaurant and sit down in the Cliff sort of townhouse down in Cork, not Cliff Townhouse, but Cliff House Hotel. Yeah. They do a beautiful, you know, five course meal and so forth for half those prices. So I think look again is the answer. Look indeed. On it. Yeah.
Right, let's have our first wine, Tomás.
Right, our first wine today is a Chablis. And we're looking at this is from La Chablisienne. And it is an Appellation Contrôlée region that has four basic grades. Petit Chablis, which is the sort of scatterings very far from Chablis. This one, which is the Appellation, which is around the village. And then down the far end of the village, which the village is in a valley that's a T-shaped valley. It's a T-shaped junction. So a road goes up, which is the part of the T going up to the top bar. And on the left and right, that's Premier Cru all the way down. And just on the lower ground is the Appellation, the village. So that's what we're drinking here. When you get down to the far end of the village, you come across, you have a T-junction road, and you look up and there's a mountain. And that's all the Grand Cru in one place. So it's probably the best and simplest and most elegant way to understand Burgundy, because you've got Appellation on the ground, Premier Cru on both sides, and then this one is the Grand Cru because it's facing south.
Right, of course.
So it's facing south, southeast, and it gets all the weather. We're dealing with a region that's about an hour and a half south of Paris, and it's up on an intercoastal, it's a plain, so it's a plateau, and it goes up very high very quickly, so several hundred metres or a few hundred metres very quickly, and you're up on a very high plain. It's the water divide for France. It's the entree eventually to the Massif Central and so forth. So on this plain, when you get just past Chablis, all the water to the north of this line drains into the Atlantic, and all the water to the south of it drains into the Mediterranean. So it's a very important little line on this. It's also a big isolated region, and it's one of these ones where your little bit of my little bit of geography just comes out. The one thing I remember, transhumance.
Yeah.
So transhumance, putting cows up and down the hills in the Alps. They do this up in this region. So they're down in the valleys during the summer, during the winter, and then they put them up into the hills during the summer. And that's because even though it's high up, it's baking. It gets baked if you're in a valley. And this little valley, it's high up of Chablis, but it's relatively steep-sided. It's cut away from the wind, and it really sort of can bake the grapes, can cook them well and ripen them brilliantly, even though it's only an hour or two south of Paris. It's still another hour and a half to get down to Burgundy, but legally it's part of it. The other thing, you know, it's really high and isolated is this where Asterix and Vercingetorix held out against the Romans. Asterix, a fictional character, but Vercingetorix, a real character. So the final defeat of the Gauls took place up here near Avalon, which is up there as well, very Arthurian. And also it's very close to Saint-Brie and Auxerre, which is where St. Patrick, the real St. Patrick, who was sent by the Pope to come here, one of the three.
Yes.
And he lived up there and worked up there. So it's a very ancient region. And they've been making wine forever. And this plain is made, a lot of it's made out of chalk, the same chalk that when you cut down through, you create the English Channel with the White Cliffs of Dover. And so when you cut down through this with the River Siran, which goes through Chablis, it's all white underneath all the vines. You see this white shimmering elegance come out of it. So Chablis takes its taste in some ways from this kind of, you know, this pearlescent white glistening undersoil, which is the sort of the chalk. And then there's thunder clouds roll across, flashing with lightning nearly constantly after the heat and then the sudden calm in the evening. You're so high up. And that's in the glass. So it's kind of, it's shattering sort of, it's a white lightning, essentially, is what we're looking at in Chablis. You can also say it well. People like to say Chablis. I love saying Chablis. Mm. And that's another part that that makes this wine work very well. It's a little unfashionable at the moment because people used to drink a lot of it. Mm. And then everyone switched because they preferred Chardonnays from the New World. And Chablis has struck back, shall we say.
Yeah.
So this one now is around €20. It's called La Chablisienne. La Pierre Lee, and it's 2015, so it's €20. You'll find them in carryout off licenses around the country, and it is a superb and excellent wine.
It's delicious. Our hashtag is Seepage Movies. Dry Hard is one of the few that can read out. Esther, what movie should we do first?
We'll be lynched if we don't do The Avengers.
Okay, here comes.
We'll keep the spoilers at the absolute minimum as well, just the fans are a bit nervous.
We'll
about
try. Everyone dies in the end. Right. Avengers are coming after this.
Tell me his name again.
Thanos. He's a plague, Tony. He invades planets. He takes what he wants. He wipes out half the population. He sent Loki. The attack on New York. That's him.
This is it. What's our timeline?
No telling. He has the power in space stones. That already makes him the strongest creature in the whole universe. If he gets his hands on all six stones, Tony.
He could destroy life on a scale hitherto undreamt of.
There you go. I think we get the gist of it from there. Yeah, Thanos is bad. He gets these six stones. Everyone's a goner.
Story in this is quite straightforward, actually. Some would say maybe a little thin.
Okay.
But you don't really see that because of the cast of thousands for the first hour or so. But yeah, as people who have seen any of the other Marvel Universe films or been acquainted with the evil Thanos, who's a great baddie played by Josh Brolin in a really good performance, motion capture performance. So he looks like himself, except he's a big CGI ogre, but you can actually see his facial movements and stuff within the performance, you know. And they do that with a few of the cast members here, most notably our own Tom Von Lawler, but we'll talk about that later. But basically Thanos wants to gather these six stones, which are very well known in the Marvel stories. They represent mind, soul, power, time, reality in space, and they're scattered across various universes and planets.
Okay.
And the Avengers might even have a couple of them themselves hidden away.
All right.
But they are useless unless you have all six of them. Mm. If you have all six of
them. What was the thing, though, in the Wonder Woman film where they had some sort of a box on her island that somebody wanted? Was that one of them, or was that a different thing?
That was a different thing, yeah.
Okay,
That was
well, a very similar plot, though.
Listen, I wouldn't bet against Warner and Disney having a chat in the next few years and Wonder Woman popping up in a Avengers Infinity War Chapter 7 movie. You know, I think they're going to keep getting bigger and bigger at these things. But it was a similar idea. It was a similar idea, you're right. So if you get all six stones, though, he will have the power to know everything and unlimited power and strength, and he can cause absolute havoc, basically, because this guy is a pretty sinister character. You get good backstory with Thanos. That's what I like about him. You get a little bit of context, even though he's a bit of a despot, you know.
Okay. Broken home, bad upbringing.
A bit more imaginative than that. He's from a planet called Titan, and there's none of the typical daddy issues. He's lived in a planet which was overpopulated and under-resourced, and the planet ended up becoming devastated, basically. Mm. So his idea is to decrease the planet, the population of various planets, or what we call in some quarters genocide, you know.
Right. Okay.
But he has a theory behind it that, you know, that the Avengers way won't work either. So that's kind
What's
of an
the Avengers way.
No genocide.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Okay. That's a straightforward choice there.
Yeah.
Really, yes.
So he's kind of he's hell bent on getting his hands on these, and very well developed character, as I say. And the Avengers decide that even Spider-Man and Captain America and the Hulk and the Black Widow, played by Scarlett Johansson, aren't going to be quite enough to take on this threat this time, because it's intergalactic. So they join forces with the guys from Guardians of the Galaxy, and that's a very amusing scene when they meet each other first, because they
how do
don't
they get
know
in contact
that they're
with
goodies
them? Do they like phone them?
They bump into them in outer space.
Of all the planets.
I know, like, you think, you know, for the space-time continuum and all that, yeah. So what would the chances be? But, that's very nicely handled, I have to say, because that was okay. My main concern going into this film. How are they going to bring in all these characters? And you know, bring in relatively new characters as well. Like, we only met the people of Wakanda not 2 months ago.
Yeah, it's
you know,
true.
In a Marvel film. Now, one of the characters had featured in Captain America, of course, but a proper, you know, we only met that universe properly in the last 2 months. So you're bringing in kind of much loved characters that are 10 years old and also quite new characters, and you're bringing in a multitude of them. Hmm. And then you're bringing in, go on.
Yeah, no, and this is a plot question. Guardians of the Galaxy, I liked, I know people didn't like the second film as much as maybe the first one, but it had a nice lightness to it. It didn't take itself that seriously.
It had a smugness as well, though. I think it might be just Chris Pratt.
Could be, maybe one of those either, you know, Marmite-y things.
Yeah,
but tonally, is Avengers more like Guardians or Guardians more, you know, are they all serious and po-faced?
Yeah, well, that's where the writers have done a super job, because people are allowed to be themselves in this.
Yeah,
and there's a hilarious scene where, I know you loved the last Thor movie, Ragnarok. Mm.
There's
a hilarious scene where Thor becomes injured and is brought into the Guardians spaceship. And the female characters of Guardians are talking about how his rippling muscles are seriously injured and stuff like that. And it's actually quite good fun. Mm. But it's not punchline action scene. There's a genuine sense of doom built up here. And like a truly shocking finale, which I will say no more than that. But we get to meet new characters as well. And, you know, for people who come out going, I thought Nidra was supposed to be in the Avengers movie, I never saw him. He's a CGI alien character.
Okay.
So you'll have to keep an eye out for him. He features very prominently in the first hour of the film, including in the opening scenes, because he's a character by the name of Ebony Maw. It's amazing performance motion capture, because like he has this mad alien face and totally unrecognizable. But once he started moving, I knew straight away it was Tom Von Lawler. And that's what they're trying to capture, I suppose, in the actors, you know, to kind of bring a bit of their natural performance to it. And I think that's what Marvel have been, and other studios have been doing really well with that format in recent years. But he's kind of the leader of three henchmen kind of tasked by Thanos with, you know, there's a lot of planets to carry out genocide on, so they kind of go around helping him out. And Ebony Maw's character as well, Von Lawler's character as well, is he's kind of a bit of a spin doctor as well. He kind of likes to put the fear in people about, you know, the approaching Thanos and why resistance will be futile. So he's really good. He's good fun, and it's a great debut for him.
Okay.
One of three movies we're going to see him in the next month, which is, you know, and very, very different roles. I think he's just great.
I want to ask you, is this the last Avengers movie? But then that might involve...
No, another Avengers film has already been revealed, and I suppose... my main beef with this film is it does feel a little bit like it's it ends on a cliffhanger, I suppose, is what we'd say. And
okay.
I don't think that ever really, really works in cinema. You know,
we've had
a run of it in recent years with, you know, the Hunger Games last film being split and the Harry Potter. I think Harry Potter started the trend, actually. And I just don't think cinema should ever be episodic like that. And I think you're in real danger going into soap opera territory then.
Captive audience, of course.
A captive audience and a massive audience. And maybe I just need to realise this is the way films are going to be made now, and these audiences lap them up, you know.
Yeah.
But I did really enjoy it. It never, it dragged in the middle for me a lot. It never justified 2.5 hours. Mm. But I would give it a 3-star, but that would be a big thumbs up 3-star. It doesn't do too many things for me to give it a 4-star, but I really like the scale of its ambition. And they've definitely succeeded in bringing all these characters together into one world.
Okay, which is complicated.
A great job from the writers in that regard, you know. And so there's a lot to recommend it. I think if you're a serious Marvel fan, you're going to absolutely adore it. And they emotionally invest you better than they have in a lot of the other Marvel films as well.
Okay, all right. Fair enough. Paul says, on the subject of spoilers, because we were talking about that, I went to see The Usual Suspects in Newry many moons ago. It was the second screening that evening, and as we queued, a man coming out of the first screen and proudly exclaimed to us all, "It's the Sham with the gammy leg."
Oh, God.
One more movie, one more film after this. 53106 is our text number that will cost you 30 cent. We are in the middle of Movies and Brews, the segment in the show that interrupts our conversations in the studio that we're having during the ad break. Tomas and Esther are still here. I have a bottle of Conde de Valdemar Gran Reserva in the boot. Should I bother removing it from said boot or leave it there and forget about it? Peter wants to know.
Well, you should definitely remove it. What we need to know is whether it's going to be enjoyable or not, and that will depend for how many summers it has been in your boot. This is a real problem with putting wines in the boot. I've often done it coming home, driving home from France, and you put wine in the boot, and of course you go in and have a sort of a Pepsi Cola at some traffic stop, and you come out and you open the doors in the car to leave, you know, to so that you can get into the oven after you've been out there. And of course the same thing's been happening in the boot as well, so it does tend to broil the wine. It's a great it's a really very lovely Rioja, and I would take it straight. If you've been in Ireland, I don't think it's had problems on the excessive heat side. And take it out of the boot and you'll enjoy it. It's good.
May well have been frozen a few times, more to the point. You're getting a lot of love today. Deborah says, I'm in love with Tomas's laugh, mix of naughty and sexy. Another reason to adore Movies and Booze. Okay.
Now I don't know what to do. Don't laugh.
David says, couple of questions for the charming Tomas. One, which wines should I be on the lookout for while on the Sancterre, northwest coast of Italy?
You should be on the lookout for Langa wines. So what you're there is in the Ligurian coast. Beautiful, beautiful spot. Byron stopped
there. Did you say Langer wines?
Langer wines, yeah. The Langer. The Langa wines. Yeah. Our Mr. Wallace TD owns some vineyards there, or owned some vineyards. Oh. I don't know the legal status of them now, but he used to own them. And Mick Wallace. Mick Wallace owns some vineyards there. And when he set up a bodega here as a restaurant, which sold ostensibly wines from the Langa from the Sancterre region.
Yeah,
which is just opposite the new bridge, the new walking bridge down from Hapenny Bridge, that little walkway through to Jove Street. That's where that is. And they've got a very extensive set of Langa wines there. So that's Piedmont, and the hills behind that is where Barolo and Barbaresco and all these rather beautiful sort of misty sort of mountaintops full of truffle and very, very unguent sort of pastas. And so they have very, very, very beautiful soft wines there, so Langa. So Barbaresco is a great wine. Keep an eye out for that and you'll enjoy it if you're there.
Okay. The second question from David is, thinking of a career change and want to do all the WSET level courses.
Yeah.
Where is best in Dublin to do the courses?
There are quite a few places to
what
do.
What are WSET? You should explain for people.
Yes, WSET courses are the way that you sort of enter the wine business if you want to. They're kind of trade they're trade exams. They have entry level exams, let's sort of level one and two, which are for people who want to get a better knowledge of wines, and that tends to emphasize the culture and tasting and so forth, and those kind of entry level sort of tier one and tier two will do that, and you don't have many exams to get through those, but you have some practicals, maybe some essay writing. Then when you get a little higher, they move up into diploma level and onto degree level stars.
Okay.
And the WSET, so it's the Wine and Spirits Education Trust. It's based in London, but it licenses things all over the world, and the MW is the top of the tree for if you're pushing on through that. Searson's, for example, do those courses. Lots of places do the courses, and what I would say is look for a place that you like the wine selection in a wine shop, and go and ask them where they did their WSET exams, if you're talking to them over the counter, and they'll have a good practical experience for what they thought about the people around them that they enjoy doing it. But it's out there. It's good.
Yeah. And Baba wants to know, how would Tomas feel about saying moist Chablis?
I will never be persuaded to say moist Chablis.
All right, you never will. All right, let's move on to our second wine of the day then. Tomas, what is this?
Our second wine our second wine today. Our second wine today is Bodegas Protos, and this is from the Ribera del Duero. So this is the place. This is Carlo in the sky with diamonds, those diamonds are wine. Those diamonds are beautiful grapes. The grape is Tempranillo, which they call Tintofino up there in the highlands. This is pretty exquisite wine. You are talking a burst of coconut on the the nose. You're talking rich, sort of dark, sweet. strawberry and blackcurrant, but the kind of blackcurrant that you would have mashed in with cream during the summer that you just picked off the side of a bush in a boreen in the west.
There's a very distinctive Ribeiro taste, actually.
There is, yeah. It has, because it has a bit of, it's too high, it's incredibly high. And that's the thing you don't notice when you're there, because it's got flat top mountains that have been, they're a bit like Cape Town, they've got them top off or essentially in Sligo as well. Mm. And you have that cut off top mountain, but you're up very high. They've got little cliffs that are only maybe 50 or 60 feet high or maybe 100 feet high. So they don't think of themselves as being a mountainous area. But in fact, the base vineyards are around 850 metres. To put that in context, Kropatrick is 740 metres high. Carrin Túil is 1,038 metres high. The vineyards in Ribeiro are from 850 to 1,050 feet sky. So they are growing wine up on the top of mountains that we wouldn't even, you know, apart from send a rescue crew once in a while to actually get, never mind
and
agriculture.
Are they doused in fog most of the time?
They have snow. I visited this particular place when it was covered in snow. But they get hot baking weather during the summer season, and it lasts a good long time. So we're talking north of Barcelona, north of Madrid, south of Rioja. So if you're looking at Spain and you hit the top of Spain, sort of with Santander and all of those locations there, and come down about sort of 3 or 4 hours towards heading towards the centre of Spain, that's where Ribeiro is. It is it's a very, very beautiful region. This it was fought over by everyone. This is where Castel and Leon were. And the kings of Leon, not the band, but the actual kings. And so they're fighting over these this whole location. And this is also where, this is Carthage. Rome came to the river Ebro, the Rio Ojo, which is the end of the Roman Empire was. And then you flip over that side, the other side, into this area. And this is where Carthage was. This is where Hannibal and his elephants were. They weren't coming the whole way from sort of Carthage in northern sort of Africa. This is where they lived. So it's been a very exotic and wild place for a very long time. And there are Roman and Carthaginian ruins up here in the mountains where they've been growing grapes for thousands of years. So we're getting onto it. But they lost it and they started growing beet, largely because of the war, World War II, when Spain was isolated like ourselves. We didn't have access to it. We start planting beet and making sugar out of it. Mm. And then, as we said, we lost that. And they were able to go back to making grapes, which they did very well. Protos was there very early on. They were the original, means origin. So they're the beginning of Ribeiro del Duero.
Actually, just a horticulture question is, yes. If you stop growing, are the vines still there, or do they have to plant the vines all over again?
The vines are still there. They have some very old vines, but they ripped a lot of them up. They did rip a lot of them up.
Oh, that's a shame.
It really is a shame. But they go dormant, and they will actually just run. Vines run flat when you don't when we don't put them up onto spikes. So it's like on the vine-covered sort of house that you see all over Ireland, where they just cling to any wall. They will just run along the ground and go up a tree and so forth. So there were some, and there some places have rescued them, but a lot of them were replanted. So a lot of them replanted. So they're all about sort of 20 to 40 years old at this stage. Protos itself is in a little town called Peñafiel, which has a fantastic castellated sort of castle with turrets on the top of a big, strong rock in the middle of it. And their tunnels and the cellar is all bored into the underneath of this castle. And they wanted to do something spectacular during their sort of housing boom and building boom in about 20 years ago in Spain. And so they commissioned Sir Richard Rogers, who made the Pompidou Centre and Lloyd's Building and Heathrow Terminal 5, loads of things. And they got him to come down and make them build them a beautiful winery, which he did, which looks like four barrels that have been up on the mountain and fell off. And so you just get the halves coming out of the ground, and they're all in a kind of they're at an angle of about 40 degrees, and it's completely sustainable and green. So you bring the grapes in the top, and they work their way through each of these huts going down. They get crushed in one, macerated in another. There's a barrel room for aging in the next one. They get bottled at the last one, and then they're out the door into a pallet and down to us for the final one. It's beautiful.
That
absolutely
sounds
beautiful
extraordinary,
thing.
And it's an absolutely lovely wine. Also, to let you know, this day week on May the 4th, we'll be on the road again. We're going to be doing a live outside broadcast from Tullamore. We're going to be in the Bridge House Hotel. That's right in the centre of Tullamore. It's also the Midlands' leading winning venue. Just need you to know that. So if you'd like to come along and be in the audience for that, all you have to do is go to newstalk.com/events. Look for the link there and follow the link there if you'd like to be in the audience. So that's today week in Tullamore. Obviously, it's a live show. It'll be going from 2 o'clock to 4 o'clock. So don't go and do it and then go, oh, actually, I've got work that day. But hopefully many people, well, I can guarantee you many people will want to go. So we'll get onto that link as soon as possible at newstalk.com/events. We'll move on to our second film of the day. It's The Delinquent Season. In this clip, a fight starts over dinner.
I don't know. You're thinking Italy, maybe?
Well, the hot Mediterranean blood, isn't that what they say? Jim is a bit of that.
What? Yeah, right.
Chris complains when a holiday's coming up, don't you?
Do I?
It happens so rarely for us.
What's that mean?
What are you talking about?
Implying something to people that isn't the case.
Chris.
I don't think she was. When have I ever complained?
Chris.
Ever? About spending time with you and the girls?
That wasn't what I meant.
Never.
We could probably do with keeping a bit of an eye on our own relationship lately.
What do you mean?
I'm going to bed.
Good!
There's often more going on in a marriage than people on the outside are ever aware of.
Yeah, I suppose.
There you go. Is that a trailer that we just heard there? Is
it
that an actual
might,
clip from the movie?
It sounds like it might be part of the trailer.
There's a trailer, sorry.
Yeah. So as I said, written and directed by Marco Rowe, who's a well-known theatre director and playwright, of course, but is directing here for film for the first time. And this is a four-hander, really. There are a couple of great supporting characters, I haven't said that, but it's really a four-hander between Cillian Murphy, he plays a guy called Jim, and his wife is played by Eva Berthissel. And their friends and neighbours are Andrew Scott and his wife, played by Catherine Walker.
Mm-hmm.
So they're kind of smug marrieds on the face of it.
Yeah.
And they, you know, they've got the kids, they've got the nice house in the suburbs, and they go in most of their, by virtue of having young kids, most of their evenings out involve dinner at each other's gaff and a little bit too much red wine.
And so the problem
all fairly normal at first, but scratch the surface then and the cracks start to show. This happens very early in the film, okay, so I'm going to go with it, but Catherine Walker's character arrives in the house one night and says her husband's after striking her, and they tell her to stay with them.
Yeah.
Cillian Murphy's character works from home, and it's not too long before the two of them start playing away from home.
Okay.
So that is then kind of the idea behind all of that is what it does to both their own relationship and marriages, but also kind of everyone around them. And it turns, you'll see mixed reviews for this one, though I really liked it. But you'll see mixed reviews mainly, I think, because it's a bit of a melodrama. It's a bit of it almost feels like a French film in some ways. That, you know, there's even sex in it. You know, in an Irish movie,
sex,
would you imagine sex scenes?
Yeah.
And Tomás is going, no.
And so, I assume we're talking about a firm handshake here rather than anything else.
So that's all the stuff that's going on. And I think I was just in the mood for melodrama that day. I thought it was really good, actually.
Yeah, well, that's often the way with the film, that it can be where you are in your head on any particular day. You can love a film or hate a film.
Now, there were kind of a couple of things I didn't quite believe, and I suppose there were little things in lines of dialogue that I suppose betrayed Marco Rowe's theatrical roots, maybe, I'd say.
Yeah.
But I just bought into it. I did. I thought Cillian Murphy was absolutely terrific in it, I have to say. And he's kind of playing on the face of it, an everyman, and kind of a character we haven't seen him play before, and playing Irish.
Yeah.
So it's all of that, you know. And he kind of hides his hand fairly well, you know, and keeps you guessing as to what kind of character he is. And that's kind of what helped me as well. You are guessing about these people's motivations and actions and consequences, and whether they'll take the selfish route or the kind of greater good route, and whether the greater good route can sometimes actually be the selfish route,
yes,
and all of that kind of stuff, you know. But very dialogue heavy, very talky. So unless you buy into this, I could see some people it not being
okay. It sounds kind of French as well, if it's very dialogue heavy as well. Lots of sex and lots of talking.
Yeah,
that's totally a French movie then.
About feelings and stuff.
Yeah, about feelings and stuff. And is everyone sitting around smoking Galois in it as well?
No, I don't think so. No. Yeah.
The hashtag is seepage movies, moist on his own petard. I don't know if that's actually a movie or not, but I wanted to read it out. I also saw today that Split has been given a sequel. Why?
Why indeed?
Yeah.
None
of us know the answer to that.
That rhymes with split was my verdict on it. But James McAvoy drove me mad as well. He drove me. Yeah, I thought it was. People were really praising his performance, but I just thought it was also manic and kind of turned up all the time. It drove me a bit mad.
And people are still texting in about a Quiet Place. I hated A Quiet Place. I couldn't eat my popcorn, and that's the main reason I go to the cinema. Indeed, that's fair enough. That's absolutely fair enough. Tomás and Esther, thank you both very much. Here's Claire to tell us about some good things to do tonight, or this weekend, I should say.
Okay, Doug, starting with tonight then, The Alarm are playing the Academy tonight in Dublin. That's at 7 p.m. This is part of their Blood Red Viral Black European Tour, and their first major tour in Europe in the last decade. Their tickets are £22.50, 01877 9999 for details on that. Tomorrow in Galway, the Curate International Festival of Literature continues, and it's running until till Sunday. Tomorrow at 11 a.m. there is the Poetry Mentorship Programme in memory of Anne Kennedy. Tickets for this are €10. You can go to curate.ie for all the details. And then on Sunday, What's That Sound are playing at 9 p.m. in the Oliver Plunkett. They are a 4-piece funk and blues acoustic outfit. You can call 021 422 2779 for all the details.
Excellent stuff. Our production team today: Niamh Hassel, Claire Collins, Michael Quilligan, Anne-Marie Kane. And that's pretty much it. Well, Ivan's up next on News Talk. We'll talk to you on Monday at 2 o'clock. Have a nice weekend.
Sponsored by Carry Out Off License. Simply better wines and beers. Carryout.ie.